On first listen, this sounds like the radio. But if you listen more closely, you can hear that that's not quite a language, or a genre, or even a time signature. It's a stream of collage, a collaboration between artificial intelligence and the artist Jared Madair. I first learned of Madair in 2008 in New York. He was living in a large, rugged RV slathered with murals, and he'd park it around New York and show different artists inside. Art hung from the ceilings and in the kitchen, and he called it Bed-Stuy Love Affair. He once parked it in front of the Whitney Museum, where he was showing his own installation of fabric and wind. Later, he moved to Los Angeles, bought a different van, and lived out of that for a while. It was around this time that he and I started speaking about music and art and herbal tonics in long emails and texts. I remember he was also posting pictures of his food on Instagram, these maximalist heaps of colorful vegetable matter, which were enticing and repellent at the same time. This is what his work is like. It's pushing and pulling the viewer with pleasure and overwhelm. It's true for his tapestries that look like digital smears of reality, or his paintings made with childlike abandon, or his standee sculptures of artificial gods. It's how he texts and how he speaks in these long, unraveling descriptions of multiplicity. He casts the minutiae of our daily lives into phantasmagoria. For this episode, Madair and I speak about his music, which feels remarkably like the experience of looking at his work. He made an album a few years ago, which he quite accurately compares to the sound of two marbles rolling around in a prism. More recently, he's made a quartet of what he calls frozen operas. These are like moving tableaux depicting some kind of alien ritual. They're not like an opera in any traditional way, because Madair isn't like a musician in any traditional way. The most recent of these operas was titled The Unpopular Courage of Duchess Orchid Drop, and it included a cast of costume characters cavorting on an artificial snowboarding slope atop a trash-burning power plant in Copenhagen. All of these operas are set to Madair's unhinged music, which he creates using artificial intelligence algorithms. He clashes pop culture references and paradoxical language together to create a new warped reality and unleash a curious form of ecstasy upon its listeners.
I don't have any relationship to concepts like scales or that kind of thing other than the most rudimentary, like, oh, this scale kind of has like a Viennese vibe. And because of that, I can't, like my decision making is, like, I imagine for you, you can kind of, like the same way you would stand in front of like a raw plot of land and be like, okay, going to build a house. Whereas for me, my relationship to music, where it's a terrain where a lot of the map is blacked out for me, it's way more growing chunks and seeing what works and kind of slapping those chunks together until I'm like, oh, this is kind of a surprise, but we like.
Yeah, it's almost the difference between an experimental approach to something and a more compositional one. And to talk about some of your AI music, that seems like maybe the best expression of what you're talking about.
Yeah, that really gets to the crux of that. there's a lot of work within AI research stuff related to this idea, where you kind of attack the logic of a system that's been trained to say, okay, like in the realm of images, this would be relevant, where you have these AIs that are trained to classify traffic lights or crosswalk lines, these kind of things. But then you also have AIs that are trained to recognize the difference between a bunny rabbit and an avocado or a pepperoni pizza. And you can kind of distort and reweight the relationships between how this artificial consciousness understands and interprets whatever you throw at it by doing these things called an adversarial attack, where you're kind of, you like an example of this in training an image set would be showing it the face of a dog and insisting that it's a pepperoni pizza, this kind of thing.
I see. You're purposely jamming the system.
And and sometimes that's more aggressive than other times, meaning sometimes it's really as simple as, oh, like, we want that summer vibe. Like throw in 2 seconds of a summer pop song, you know? And other times it's way more, let's tell it that it's this thing that it actually isn't, and then tell it to do the opposite of that, and the whole thing comes out inside out. You can tell it that it's created in a language that it was not. You can do things like classify it as a genre that it is not. The some of the systems are also trained, they're actually trained on cultural signifiers that you and I would recognize. Like, they know what Tupac sounds like. They know what Blondie sounds like. They know what Janis Joplin sounds like. So you can kind of triangulate those things and ask them to blend those things together. Like, you could say, okay, we're going to feed it a very brief snippet, maybe something anywhere from 1 to 10 seconds of a song. Then we're going to say that the song is sung by Blondie, but we're going to tell it that we, even though it's not, and then we're also going to tell it that we want to add a duet by Pitbull, and then we're going to feed it Portuguese lyrics, that kind of stuff. The way interacting with an AI works, to interact with a breathing consciousness that way would be extremely intrusive. It would be the equivalent of you giving the person all kinds of drugs and truth serums and giving them, you know, cutting open their brain and mushing things around, because you can get quite aggressive with it. You know what I mean? I've also engaged in these other kind of collaborations within my sculptural work, where I'll do things like work with a tattoo artist and say, okay, I'd like you to take these squid and chop up all these squid bodies, take the body parts of the squid and create a drawing of two teenage boys masturbating together in prison. And that is completely up to them how they interpret that description. So that is a similar type of play with subjectivity, where it's, okay, we have this concept or we have this description of a narrative circumstance. How is that going to be pictorially represented? There's a billion different ways to do it. It could be from the perspective of outside the bars. It could be a camera inside one of the boy's urethras looking at the other boy who's masturbating on the opposite side of the cell. It could be from the perspective of a bacteria on one of their shoes. You know, there's many ways that one could experience this scene. And yeah, so I guess to me, working with AI became a very natural continuation of that idea of working with other people's interpretations. all of these systems, it's very useful to think about the way your mind jumps to conclusions to define a form. Whether that be, you know, we've all had the experience of walking into a dark apartment and there's an object that resembles a person and it makes you jump. Or you catch a glimpse of something and believe it's one thing and then come around the corner and, oh, it's actually not that at all. Or a shift in scale, you know, where you see a photograph of something and it appears to be this huge thing. You're like, oh, whoa, what is that? It's a, that looks like it's the edge of a cruise ship that crashed in a desert. It's like a shiny white piece of plastic that resembles the hull of a ship. And then there's some kind of beige texture that kind of looks like sand. And then you see a clearer version of the same photograph and you go, oh no, that's like the edge of someone's sneaker on a sidewalk. You know, this same kind of thing. And that is a good way to think about the way all of these things work. I guess the big difference is with sound, it's happening across time instead of 2D space. So a way to think of it would be you take a snippet of audio, you know, and it's okay. Are we going to interpret that as that is the first blip of someone who's about to scream? Is it the first blip of someone who's about to stutter out the words, I love you? Is it the first blip of someone choking because they're trying to eat ice cream that's too cold? There's a protocol that it's basically like if you gave birth to a baby with a blindfold on, then when it was able to move its hands, you plopped it down in front of a computer and you put a shroud over its head. So the only thing it could see is the screen. This baby is not going to comprehend spatial relationships beyond clicking the mouse. And you just let that baby self-educate just by crawling the entirety of the internet. So what happens is a lot of concepts become blurred together by things like typos. For instance, if you want an image of a desert, it's very difficult to get that without it also putting dessert in it for some reason. Do you see what I mean? Because very often people conflate the spellings of those two things online. Another example of this would be use of emojis, because it's also trained on Instagram. So if you use the peach emoji or the like the strong arm emoji, if you said, I want to see an underwater skyscraper, it would show you an underwater skyscraper. Then if you said underwater skyscraper with the strong arm emoji, it would try to take the qualities that it understands from images tagged with a strong arm emoji on Instagram. So for instance, it might suddenly become a strangely muscular building. It would be looking at pictures. Basically, in that case, the reference would be like, what types of images does that emoji show up with most often? It's usually a picture of a dude that just got finished with his workout, showing like gains in the mirror of the gym changing room. So it might have other weird tropes. For instance, if a trope of those images is that the guys are usually shirtless, listening to an iPhone that's strapped to their arm with headphones plugged in, the building might start to get weird features like a rectangle strapped to a certain part of it with wires moving around toward the top of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it becomes almost a study of people.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Like this hyper mirroring system into how people relate to themselves and describe each other. The interesting thing about these systems is they can also traverse space between concepts that have never been linked before. And you can also define them as an inversion. So in that way, it becomes quite powerful in that you can say, okay, I want to take the concept of the juiciness of a peach and the arduousness of dedicating 9 years of your life to a PhD program. I want to land 33% of the way between those two concepts, but then I want to invert the relationship between all that. And then you're somewhere really far out that I don't even know how to describe.
And when you're selecting the peach and the PhD program, I mean, there's actually, as I say it, I realize that there is a linguistic relationship between those two things. And maybe that's how you arrived there. But you too are serving this function where you are trying to push your mind to unexpected polarities and relationships between ideas, right? I mean, you have to engage with it in such a way where you are creatively pushing against the expectations of the system.
Yes, yes. That's also, of course, I think with a lot of this stuff, this has been such a trope with digital creative tools for so long. I mean, dating back to like the example that always slaps me the hardest is like the first drum machines being created, the idea being, oh, well, no one would ever want to use this on a record, but if you were like a session drummer or wanted to experiment with a beat and you were in a hotel room where you couldn't practice the beat, you could have this little toy where you plot out rhythms. And then it's like, oh, well, hold on. That's actually the seed of the last 40 years of music. I didn't fully flesh out that thought. You know, these kind of classic critiques of like early rave music or this kind of thing where people would be like, that's not music, that's not composition, that's some junkie like playing Game Boy. It's so limited. It's basically the machine is making the music for you. You know what I mean? And then if you actually delve into these systems, you're like, well, there's actually a lot you can do with this. And the AI stuff is very similar in that it's far from some automagic process. There's a lot of wrangling with this thing. Every sonic fragment of that is generated raw via AI, and then it's collaged together. There are some other sounds interjected into that that aren't completely AI, but nothing is sampled, meaning it, like the sounds that would be interjected into that would be things like grinding a rock against a piece of glass and then swirling around the pitch spectrum of that. But the anything that sounds like human music or the things that people would likely think, oh, that's like some kind of mashup of some existing song. No, all that is the raw audio for that is completely synthesized using AI. A lot of the music I've created for the Frozen Opera stuff all comes based on this synthetic acoustic idea of being in this space that is, like if you've ever been in the Vatican and this series of vaulted chambers, right? You're in one room, then you walk into another, and there's kind of multiple domes. They're all connected. So if you imagine a space like that, and then you are hovering in the middle of it, but there are domes below you and also to the sides of you. So it's kind of like mirroring the domes of a vaulted architecture in a kaleidoscopic way. So it's kind of taking that space, this kind of imaginary acoustic space, and then turning that into a turbine that whirls around. And then while it whirls, the size of the architecture shrinks and expands the same way that within a traditional acoustic body, like the interior of a violin, the way that that governs so much about how the strings sound and the way that resonates and this kind of thing. And the difference between a viola and a cello. So if you imagine a cello that's constantly morphing between being the size of a matchbox and the size of an aircraft carrier, and the way that acoustic space changes those sounds as it expands and contracts, that is the model for how all that music is created.
What feeling are you generally looking for when you make music?
That's an interesting question. I guess I always think about this kind of experience of, like, if you have a child and, you know, you're like normal, quote, working adult or whatever, you're preoccupied with your adult things. And sometimes you walk through the room and you see the kid and let's say they're playing Crash Bandicoot, and you see, oh, there's like this orange thing that jumps around. He's in a jungle. He's kind of goofy. Maybe he's clumsy. I don't really know. Like, my kid's really into it. And then, you know, at the breakfast table, you know, they're like, Mom, Dad! You know, Crash Bandicoot, did you know that he did this and he did that and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, I know, whatever. And then there's the video game convention and you take the kid to the convention and there's the statue of Crash Bandicoot and there's Crash Bandicoot and they're wearing the neon green sneakers and they're wearing like this special weird hat. And for the kid, and there's some other character next to them that you've never seen. And to the kid, it's this super rich universe where they know everything about it. And they're like, oh, those are the neon sneakers. He only got the sneakers when he, you know, defeated the Peach Princess. And I'm really interested in that, like different degrees of legibility based on prior information. And an example of this is, you know, you arrive in a foreign country, there's a celebration, you know, you come out of the plane, there's a bunch of people marching around in the street and they're carrying stuff and they're singing or they're chanting or they're doing whatever they're doing. And you're like, oh, well, I know some things because I've seen some shows on TV. I went to school for some years. I can kind of approximate some things about this. Like, maybe this is religious. Maybe it's political. Maybe it's something else. Maybe, you know, and you're kind of interpreting this based on whatever cues are present. And I always think of the Frozen operas as that sort of experience where for a viewer from our reality coming into contact with them, it's kind of like, okay, so what am I looking at? I'm looking at something. It's celebratory. Is it celebrating something that the foundation of that society is built upon? So it's kind of happy about it. Is it looking back on a traumatic event and we're reminding the society about that event? Or, you know what I mean, these kind of questions. For me, that becomes a kind of delightful thing to play with, to be like, okay, we're dialing in this vibe. The vibe is we're wearing the big blocky stone shoes. We're standing on the deck of a ship where the wood is very thin. So there's a certain anxiety with every step because maybe your boots are going to crack through the wood and you're going to fall down to the next level. We're also going to put a little bit of Disney sparkle in there because we all know when the timpani bells come in with that glittery sound, we see the stars shooting over Epcot Center or whatever the name of the castle at the beginning of every Disney movie is. Then we're going to also put in some purple sunset energy with some everyone's bringing the birthday cake toward you when you just walked into the surprise party energy, and to kind of be able to blend all those things together.
Thanks for listening to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. As always, feel free to send us a note at subjectobjectverb@artreview.com, giving your own personal definition of artificial intelligence.